Welcome to UCD Business Impact, the podcast at the UCD College of Business, where we explore fresh ideas, bold thinkers, and the forces shaping business and society. My name is Maeve Houlihan. I'm the director of the undergraduate UCD Lachlan Quinn School of Business. And you may have noticed that in a change to your usual scheduling, this episode is not being hosted by our usual host, Mr. Emmett Oliver. Instead, this week, I'm delighted to say that Emmett is indeed our guest for the podcast. Many listeners will know that Emmett is a man of many hats. He's a journalist, broadcaster, former editor of the Sunday Business Post, and now he's the author of a new book, Irish Nation Building, Government, Business and Power, 1922 to 1958. And it is that very auspicious work we're here to discuss today, along with a broader conversation with Emmett about his life and work and views. Emmett, you're very welcome to your own podcast.
I know, it's a very peculiar name. I'm inside out or upside down. I'm not sure which it is. Yeah, I never thought this would happen. It's fascinating. I feel slightly nervous and peculiar being on the receiving end of questions when I'm normally doling them out myself. So I am apprehensive, I have to say, about the conversation, but interested as well in what the two of us can discuss. It's only going to be a half an hour, listeners, so I know they get enough of me belly full most of the time, so getting it too much this time might be excessive, but hopefully they'll find a few of the strands interesting. And I think the two of us have mapped out a very diverse conversation with a lot of different themes in it, so hopefully it'll attract some interest and ears to it. So I'm delighted to be here.
That is absolutely the case. And you know, Emmett, we're very proud that, of course, you teach business and communication to our students, along with hosting our Business Impact podcast. Could you give us a quick origin story, Emmett? Who are you? Where do you come from?
Sure, yeah. Well, I am a Dubliner. I do come from the south side of Dublin. No crime in that, but I do have roots as well in West Clare. My ancestors come actually from Milltown Malbay, Spanish Point in West Clare. So I'm a man of the West as well as a man of the East. And yeah, I suppose I'm a Dubliner, educated in Ternier College and a UCD graduate. So that's where I did my primary degree, yes, in modern history. And it would have been taught by some of the masters of the craft of that time, the likes of Ronan Fanning and Mary Daly and so on, some of whom are still going strong in the historical domain. So that would have been my primary degree. And I graduated in the mid-90s. And I suppose the really interesting thing about that was I was looking up some figures, as I tend to do about that, and unemployment in Ireland in the mid-90s was at 12%, which I was kind of surprised by because I don't remember it being like that, the false memory syndrome. But unemployment now is about 4%. We're essentially at full employment. So it was a difficult time to be coming out. But like young people and graduates now, you don't really notice the sort of circumstances around you that much because you're so full of energy and sort of the future is your main focus. So yeah, so I was always interested in current affairs, Maeve, the news. I used to watch as a child, you know, Today Tonight and Brian Farrell, another famous and noted UCD academic, and Pat Kenny, who's still going strong in News Talk 106. And I would have been really as somebody who observed events in Northern Ireland and in the Republic of Ireland during the 1980s as I grew up, and would have just read and consumed all of that sort of stuff, and would have moved in then into the more, I suppose, framed study of history through the likes of Joe Lees and the Roy Fosters and that sort of canon of Irish historical research. So that's kind of what I'm interested in. And then over the years, I was a business journalist. So I've really been lucky in my more recent years to be able to combine media, history, business, all the three interests in together, which not many people get to do. It's just the way the pieces fell for me in that sense about some doctoral work I did and also this book that you've mentioned. So I've been very, very fortunate in various contexts to be able to study and observe the things that I'm most interested in, which, you know, not everyone gets to do.
Well, I think that's all of our benefit. It shows in your conversations that you have with each of your guests on the podcast. But you know what? Let's dive into it because, Emmett, you've created this extraordinary text, Nation Building. For you, what are you speaking about when you speak about nation building?
Yeah, it's a sort of a very diffuse concept. You see it written, you know, written about in a whole range of different disciplines. At the sort of cosmetic level, I suppose, it's the infrastructure of a country, of a state. So it's like the constitution, the courts, the flag, the laws, Which we all hold very dear, but it's not necessarily the thing that impacts people most directly in their lives. But it's the structures, the foundations, the framework, the timber that you get inside a country in terms of structure. But after that, I kind of said, yes, but what if you don't have prosperity? You can have a wonderful flag, you can have great embassies, which we see a lot of very poor countries have, and you can have a constitution as well. But if you don't have the material circumstances and you don't have the prosperity, it's not going to be a very happiness-inducing existence for the people and the citizens of that country. So I suppose nation building is trying to get the subject population to identify with this country, to give over their taxation, to allow to be coerced sometimes, occasionally, when it comes to the law and so on. So I suppose it's the social contract coming together where you get a nation, you get all the laws and you pay the taxes. But the government and the authorities, they give you public goods. They provide, you know, the right circumstances for a happy life. And that's the contract between the two of us. So I suppose that's what nation building is. And it's not easy. The world is full of failed states. The world is full of states that used to be powerful and no longer exist. And the world, of course, is full of states that are involved in wars and famines and so on. So this is not easy stuff. Success is not guaranteed. And we have lots of books about what can go wrong and lots of books about what can go right. The margins are very, very skinny. And we all know, and Maeve, I'm sure you'd agree with this, you are really the product of your geography and where you originally are born and where you grow up and so on. That will probably be the biggest determinant of your future. And nation building is part of that. What kind of nation or country do you grow up in? And a nation, of course, it's like an imagined, it's a myth-making exercise. Ultimately, you know, we make and tell stories about different countries and what's important and so on. I suppose we write our own script as citizens of these nations. But it's a very important concept because without it, people just will not comply. They will not go along and they will not form that state for very long until they think it's a legitimate exercise.
Well, yeah, but of course, like, Ireland is an extraordinarily interesting case, or at least we like to think so, because of the timelines, you know. In particular, it's within our more or less living memory, you know, the origins of the state in 1922 and that context that led to it. Would you chat a little bit about that, the origins, I suppose, and why you're looking at the timelines that you are?
Yeah, I suppose we all went to, well, not all of us, but lots of us went to school in Ireland and we read the traditional history we were given at the time, and we learn about the Easter Rising and the War of Independence and all these events from the early part of the 20th century. But what we don't know is that the politicians of the time, the political leaders, they really didn't have a form book or a manual to pull down from the shelf to guide them on how do you nation build. Because if you think about it, at that time, India was not decolonized. Most of Africa was not decolonized. Lots of countries around the world, if they were decolonized, they'd only be a very short period. So it was quite an unusual country in itself. So in other words, they couldn't pull down a manual that found a Western European country that hadn't been a colonial power like France had been, Britain, Spain. There really wasn't a country like Ireland. So they couldn't really just sort of say, well, let's just replicate what this other state did. So they had to kind of make it up as they went along with a lot of experimentation, some of which worked, some of which didn't work, and some that's probably in the middle part of the column. Some of it was good and bad. So there was this very difficult thing where 50% of the population may have worked in agriculture. We didn't have a steel industry. We didn't have a cement industry. We didn't really have very large universities. And really, there was a very small sliver of an elite that really ran most of the main businesses and most of the commercial enterprises. So it was not easy. Obviously, you had the Civil War as well. And of course, Britain had moved out and there was no guarantee that they would give us continued access to the British market for our goods. We did end up having it, but there was no guarantee of it. So the colonial inheritance we got was mixed. There were some good things. We had decent banks. A lot of farmers owned their own land, which was good to see. That was better than some other places. But overall, it was really a journey into the unknown where really they were on their own. They didn't have a bond market. They didn't have US multinational companies like we have today to rely on. So it was very, very kind of like clutching along. And unfortunately, it took many decades to get the policy mix right that guaranteed prosperity for all of us. And we're all, I suppose, the descendants of that success now, but it was far from guaranteed in those early years, Maeve, when really the people that were running Ireland were very inexperienced. A lot of them were very socially and culturally conservative, but they weren't experienced. And they were dealing with these great statesmen in the UK, like Churchill, of course, and David Lloyd George and so on, people who were very experienced. So it was a tough time. And there was no, as I said, rule book they could draw on. And you really see that in the documents that I've hopefully assembled in the book.
You do, Emmett. And, you know, there's something positive, I think, about even just pausing on that point, because I'm a great fan of Henry Mintzberg and, you know, his whole idea of strategies deliberate and emergent. And he just keeps reminding us how often we kind of like to imagine that the rule book is guiding us, but actually so much is the strategy is emergent in even in, you know, in business and so on. So you have very methodically analysed four particular industries. And I guess it has led you, you know, through archive research and through unearthing new stories to come to some conclusions about some of the things you think we did right and some of the things that perhaps were surprising or questionable. Would you take us through some of your top line thoughts on that, Emmett?
Yeah, I suppose the counterintuitive one, and maybe the disappointing one to get that out of the way, was just how slow and paralysed the policymakers were for quite some time. Like, we all talk a lot about free secondary education, and it was a great achievement, but it didn't come till 1967, you know, many decades into the free state that we inherited from the 1920s. Same with electrification, was quite slow in Ireland as well, particularly in rural communities. So I noticed then when I went and looked at other countries, they'd done a lot of this stuff before Ireland. Now, there's a whole range of, you know, institutional and structural reasons for that. But nevertheless, I suppose the thing I really kind of was struck by was how many people in those early decades were kind of slightly written off socially and economically. They were allowed to emigrate, you know, under duress. Some of them obviously went of free will and just wanted to get out of Ireland, but others, it was purely economic and not by choice. And there wasn't a lot of the time much done about that for quite many years. The first commission on migration wasn't until the 1950s. You know, it just wasn't an issue that was looked into in any meaningful way before then. So that was the disappointing side. You know, that was the side where you did wonder about the stasis and the paralysis in the policy process. But on the other side, you know, you do see some very, very good investments and some very bold projects. Obviously, Ard na Cruithe, which we were all told and taught about in our school days in the Southwest, that was a very important project, and there were many others. But there was that lack of, you know, big thinking. There wasn't any great moonshots going on in the time. These were conservative people in the main. They ran the budget and the fiscal position fairly conservatively as well. So if you had to go back, Maeve, in time and say, what should they have done differently? And it's a crude thing to say, and it's a trite thing to say in many respects. But I do think some of those big investments might have been done earlier. I think they might have been more expansionary in a fiscal sense earlier, and just put a lot of those investments where you get the linkages, you know, into industry and so on, again, in the social capital side as well, just have done them a little bit earlier. That came across quite strongly to me. But what you really get, you asked me about the four industries in particular, I suppose there you get those industries are being asked to kind of put their shoulder to the wheel in a national development effort. So the railways are being asked to kind of bring their prices down so people can move agricultural goods off for export. The banks are being told to lend at cheaper rates to the government and the general customer base. And then the insurance companies are being told to kind of lower their rates and restructure and make better offerings. And then finally, the shipping industry is also being compelled to sort of, you know, lower their rates to make access into the British market more cheap. So that was the interest of these early politicians, but the businesses did not necessarily see it that way. So there was very much no convergence between what the businesses of these early decades wanted and what the state wanted. But over the decades, and I suppose we're living in that economy now, the business world and the government world have started to converge and have sort of found an easy relationship with the US multinationals who come in a later stage. But at this point, Maeve, the business establishment is Anglo-Irish. It's mainly Protestant in terms of affiliation. It's holding the power, and it takes quite a long time for their interests to slip in beside the interests of the state builders, if you want to call them that.
Struck, you were talking about railway in particular, and you mentioned, you know, 26 separate rail companies, then forming the Great Southern Railway Company. That must have been extraordinary just to achieve that.
Yeah, I mean, the railways were amazing. I mean, like, one of the ones I like to talk about is the West Clare Railway, because I've got a connection back there, right? And Percy French made it famous, right? Because it was always, or could be, slightly slow, according to him, at least, in this song. But, like, you see that railway route now, and it runs, actually, ironically, into the Trump property in Doonbeg, which is irony of ironies. But the really interesting thing about the railways was they were seen very much as local employment projects and projects to create value locally. And they didn't necessarily go where the planners in Dublin would have wanted them to go, whereas the French railway system was very kind of centrally coordinated. So, in other words, the state would say, we want to run a railway from here to there, and that's where it'll go, and nowhere else. Whereas the development of railways, it was very much the British trying to kill home rule with kindness, building a lot of them in the 19th century to pacify the local population and, I suppose, tamper down some nationalistic leanings in various areas. So was it commercially rational a lot of the time to build certain railways and have 26 companies? Probably not, but it might have been politically rational. And in that sense, you could see why they did it. And nowadays, I suppose, railways are coming back into vogue because of climate change and so on. But for most of the history of the Free State, they weren't necessarily that important. The 20th century is probably about the advent of the car and wheeled transport rather than the railways, and then airlines obviously coming in and allowing the Irish exporters to get out the island in the 50s, 60s and 70s. So the railways are kind of important in the 19th century, less important in the 20th century, but getting quite important now in the 21st century. So they're having a rebirth, the railways, after a long time, I suppose, in the doldrums.
They are. And a footnote to that West Clare, as a fellow West Clareite story, is I suppose just the sadness of the actual closing down of those railways and the unpicking and unpacking of the tracks that really now are in many ways so badly needed, but sometimes are becoming the sites of greenways and other types of new futures for regions, as you said, regions being the focal point there. So, Emmett, when you think about what we got right, I guess we are always trying to learn from history. What would be some of the key moments that you would really want us to bear in mind?
Yeah, sure. I think the 50s is probably the decade where you get this very poor economic performance, and migration to the UK in particular rockets up again. You have what we call the lost decade in the 50s. And really, it's out of that crisis that the modern Irish economy is born. And we're all living in that modern Irish economy. And anyone who's listening to us now is in some ways, even at the periphery, a beneficiary of it. So I suppose the change around and the charting of a new direction in the 1950s was very impressive. Now, T.K. Whittaker, a famous Irish civil servant, is associated with that. John A. Costello was probably another man that probably deserves some credit. But there's a whole cast of characters that were involved in that recharting moment where we really cast off protectionism and moved towards free trade and the attraction of foreign capital, which is really what we have today. And yes, people might say that was, you know, looking back and hindsight as a great friend, people might say, well, you know, they had no choice. They were kind of in a cul-de-sac at that point, an economic cul-de-sac. But that's easy to say now. They could easily have gone in various other directions. We could have had political trouble again. We could have had violence even. We could have taken a step back and become very much a closed off command-based economy. So it wasn't necessarily ordained that they would find the right recipe at that point, but they did. Some people will say they stumbled on it. And that recipe was to open up, to internationalize, to educate more people at a higher level. So bringing up the human capital performance of Ireland. So all of these things were done in the 50s, 60s and 70s. It didn't mean there was no other crises. Of course, the 1980s was a tough period, as was the financial crisis of 2010 and 11 and so on. But overall, the direction of travel has been broadly successful. It has lowered migration. It has lowered unemployment. It has produced a much better performance in terms of national income and GDP per capita and all the metrics that we pay attention to. So I suppose that to me is the big moment that I would look towards. But opportunities were squandered. I mean, I do cover the shipping industry in particular in depth in the book. And, you know, we didn't really have a great shipping industry. We really haven't had one for a long time. We've never quite kind of managed to build a mercantile marine in Ireland. We've had it at various times. We've had Irish Shipping and state-owned companies, B&I Line and so on. But we've never quite consummated that success. And it might have been, as an island, an area you would have expected a success, but it just didn't come. The investments weren't made and the emphasis wasn't there either in private business or at government level to make that happen. So, yes, it's an unusual story, the Irish economy. Maybe you'll know there's the three stages. Some economies stay in agriculture, then they move into manufacturing, and then they eventually transition into services. Ireland kind of skipped the middle part in only the way that the Irish economy could do. They kind of went from agriculture straight into services. Now, I'm simplifying it a little bit, but that's the broad direction of travel that occurred at the time. We never had a mass manufacturing industry the way the United Kingdom did, and even in some ways the way the United States have had. So that's been good for us because we haven't had this big deindustrialization trend, which is what's fired up, I suppose, these current populist movements in both Britain and the US. So Ireland is quite radically different in ways we probably don't appreciate because of its evolution. All the trouble that we had in the 20th century may protected us from some of the political challenges of the 21st century, because we didn't have to let the air out of that big industrial bubble that the other countries that I mentioned would have had.
Yeah, I was really struck, you know, when you wrote that we had literally missed not one but multiple industrial revolutions, and in some ways I hadn't looked at it that way, but you've articulated it greatly there. So I guess you've seen us move into services and really the decisions of the 50s laying the foundations for our current multinational economy. That seems to be really a conclusion, Emmett. But now that we're kind of here looking at this new phase, a totally new phase of a changing world of business, given everything that you've uncovered really about how business and government collaborates and clashes over all of this period of time, what do you think we should be really holding in mind as we look forward to, and particularly mindful of the new sectors that are really prominent in our mind, you know, from energy and technology on to priorities like housing and health? But what do you think we should be keeping to the fore now, Emmett?
Yeah, I think we can learn some lessons, valuable ones from history. Irish history in particular. And I mentioned earlier in our conversation the failure to bring in those big investments early enough in the earlier phase of Irish history. And I suppose it's trying to avoid that happening again in the future. As you've said, the population of Ireland is increasing very rapidly. We're heading towards, depending on which forecast you believe, we could be 7 or even 8 million people in the next few decades. So that's going to force us to make those investments, whether we want to make them or not, just by a demographic trigger. So I suppose the trick is going to be, what are we going to back? Where are we going to put our chips on the table? You've mentioned energy. There's obviously as well the whole technology infrastructure. And then there's, of course, the housing piece, which is a real difficult pressure point at the moment. So there is going to have to be choices made. And I just hope that we come to that differently than we did in the 30s and 40s, where we just seem to be a bit paralysed. And this time around, we back the right horses that pay off for us. And ultimately, public investment will return value if it's made correctly and in the right areas. So I suppose that's going to be a very interesting project to witness for all of us over the next few years. We have this sovereign wealth fund, which is stuffed full of many billions of euros, depending on when you make the count. So it's not a cash issue anymore, it's more a vision issue. So do we have the political vision, the social vision, the economic vision to put all those billions into the right areas and get a return for people who probably aren't even born as we record this podcast? I suppose, I mean, it's a little bit frustrating in the sense that, you know, we have to see where business power is. Obviously, Ireland has a big multinational community and it's been very good for us. Can we keep that particular model going? How sustainable is it? I suppose on one level, there's a group of people who would say it's quite sustainable. We have the companies, they're here for a long time. They've drawn great value from being located here. And we now have the universities and the human capital to support those clusters. On the other hand, you'll have people saying, you know, is it sustainable long term to have that imbalance between indigenous industry and overseas industry? That will eventually catch up on you, even if it takes a good few decades. So we'll have to see which one of those visions proves right over the long term. Maybe it's probably somewhere in the middle. It's probably trying to find balance and, you know, some kind of halfway house where both those industrial models can prosper. But it's going to be interesting. If I knew the answer, I'd be writing a separate book. I can only really talk about what happened before, but the future is going to be very interesting because I do feel we're at a bit of a crossroads point and certain decisions cannot be put off for much longer. So the political class will be forced to sort of declare their hand, I suppose, over the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah. And I you know, we need thoughtful people in that political class and business class with big vision, but also the capacity to see around corners. And I think, you know, that's been something very hopeful about this journey and this documentation that you've created through the archives. I guess, Emma, because of my own interest and all of our interest really in the rising generations, do you feel that the history is something that is important to be in our curriculum?
Yes, I really do. And I think I have a concern there because history now is, in some ways, it's not studied as much as it used to be. But on the other side, it's everywhere. I mean, it's automated. It's on various chatbots and platforms. So in other words, there's no shortage of empirical history. You can get a lot of it. It wasn't always accessible in previous decades and centuries. So we're drowning in history on one level and it gets used and abused. But on the other hand, it's what I would call the veneer of history. We're probably less likely to dip below certain slogans and headlines, and it gets packaged up very easily. So the analytical history, that where the real value is and the real depth, is probably more in the sidings and in the margins at the moment. So it's trying to bring those, you know, not so much what happened on what date, which is on Wikipedia. It's more like, why did something happen on a certain date and why did it happen the way it happened? So that deeper, I suppose, reference pointing and depth is probably not as, you know, in demand. It doesn't have as much commercial value, whereas the other stuff that's very superficial probably is a bit easier and people can dash off books pretty easily. You know, it doesn't take it. They can even be written now by artificial intelligence programs. So in some ways, history is easily obtainable, but it may be lacking its instructive power as a result of that. So I do have a bit of a worry about that. But as somebody who teaches a fair bit of it around, you know, there is huge thirst out there for this kind of material. Youngsters, in some ways, they don't have the time. They're very time pressured. They don't have the time to, you know, mine away reading a lot of books and reading a lot of content. They really want people to be explainers and contextualizers. So there is actually a lot of demand and hunger for this kind of teaching and for this kind of material. You can see it also coming through popular history. You know, you can look at the book sales and you can look at everything from programs like Downton Abbey, for example, which is in the theatres at the moment. There's this huge, you know, interest in what went before. Why do certain things look like they do? Why is there certain practices and certain historical events from the Kennedy assassination right down to World War II? There's just huge cottage industries have gathered and accumulated around these events. So I don't think they'd ever lose that. But at the format of history, from podcasts like the one we're doing, right over to books, to social media, it just is popping up in different places and packaged up in different ways than your conventional book publishing industry.
Yeah. So I really love that idea, Emma. I guess that it's much more important that we talk it through, grapple with it, and even question, you know, the facts of history to better understand them. It's what's happening here and right now. Just to close, Emma, you did this extraordinary piece of research through a lot of journalistic skills, you know, digging in the archives. I guess for our rising generation and even all of us, how can we be more critical consumers of history and business stories? And what would you like us to take from what you've learned?
Yeah, I think so. I suppose that the trick is, as I said earlier, to kind of get below the empirical stuff. So that's very important. Somebody has to form the historical record. We can never recreate the past exactly as it happened because we weren't there or we aren't there now. But if you look at history and you try to get underneath the hood and get below the surface, I think that's where the value is. So everyone knows most of the main dates of the 20th century. that's not very contested particularly. I mean, there's obviously, you know, certain people who are denialists of certain events, but they're a fringe group. Most of the main events are known about and you can go and go to the museums, you can watch the movies. It's maybe to try and drill down a little bit more and kind of explore down into the depths. I think that's where the value for young people and people older like myself who can get the extra value when we do those kind of exercises. So, you know, pick an event. You know, you meet a lot of people I meet and they're going through their Spanish Civil War period or their American Civil War period, or like in Irish history, they're going back into the events of 1916, or a lot of people are very interested in how the Northern Irish conflict began. Whatever the event is, whatever the era is, whatever the context is, you know, take it on as a project. It doesn't have to be academically based, and, you know, spend a few months, you know, exploring an event, an era, personality or whatever. It's immensely enjoyable, like, and you'll also get great learning. So I don't think it should have to be a chore. And the great thing about all the new formats, Maeve, is you can pick the one that fits in with your lifestyle. If you want to do it via podcast, if you want to do it by book, if you want to do it by social media or some combination thereof, it's all there for you. So as I said earlier, there's never been as much history available. So it's just about, I suppose, taking the opportunity and fitting into something that you enjoy and find interesting and exploring it yourself. It doesn't have to be vocational. It doesn't have to lead to a job or lead to a career, but it will give you something different, sort of a, I suppose, a vantage point that virtually no other discipline will ultimately give you.
Well, Emma, thank you so much. Thank you for doing that work for all of us today. And I think you've whetted a lot of appetites. So we'll continue to think big, ask the deeper questions. I'm very glad that you're guiding our students and indeed community in thinking about business communication and history. And we're the better for it, Emmett.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity. I said I was very nervous being on the other side. I'm not hopefully going to make a habit of it, but you've been a great interviewer and I've really enjoyed the questions. And hopefully some of the answers are certainly some food for thought for those listening.
Absolutely. Thank you, Emmett.
Now, if you enjoyed this week's episode of the UCD Business Impact Podcast, please subscribe to episodes on Apple Podcast or Spotify. We cover a broad range of topics with insights from business leaders around the world, so there's sure to be something there for everyone. I'd like to thank our production team of Beth Gormley and Mike Liffey. They work tirelessly in the background, sourcing interviewees, editing, promoting episodes, and everything in between. I've been your host, Emmett Oliver, and we hope you can join us next time on UCD Business Impact.